I'm opening. We have an eye, part of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
There we go.
Welcome, everybody, back to Anatomy of a Movie. We are doing our Thanksgiving special film in this podcast, Planes, Trains, Automobiles, a great 1987 John Hughes film. And we have our full panel here, and I am your host, Marissa Serafini. Joining me, I have
Sarah Stratton.
Hello, everybody. Dimitri Panos.
We have Phil Spitek in the booth. Say hello, Phil.
Hello, everybody.
And hey, we Bill. Have our special guest with us, Cammy Martinez. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, Cammy.
Hi.
Cammy, you are director of Technicolor.
Correct.
And yes. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also expecting John Hughes is going to slip in and to talk about this fun movie as well.
And we're going to
miss his flight.
He missed his flight. He's taking a train.
Thanksgiving vacationing, you know, the whole traveling is getting in the way of him.
Hopefully he gets here eventually.
Yeah. And we're going to utilize a new part of this, well, not a new old part of the set when he comes in.
Oh, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
He'll be the first person on the couch.
Yes, the couch we usually don't see. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, a great John Hughes film. I would definitely say a classic right now. What are your overall thoughts of this movie?
So this movie I probably saw the first time maybe like 10 years ago. But so I had to revisit it, and what were you about to say?
I'm just saying,
what
did you lead with?
I don't know.
Came out.
I can't lead with that because this isn't funny.
It
this
is.
Whole we get here and literally the just joke is me not being born for this is just kept rattling. No, I was not born during this film, but I still like it.
It's a great movie.
Although I must say, a lot of things would have been solved if it was now. Cell phones. More prominent, not always have to use dial tone. I don't know.
Yes, internet.
Things
internet,
I don't understand. ATMs, I don't exactly. comprehend. To me, there was just so many solutions, but they didn't exist.
It didn't exist in 1987. 26 years ago.
So, Dimitri, what do you think of this film?
Oh, well, I love this movie. I mean, I grew up in the 80s. John Hughes, big fan. And, you know, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was one of his first forays where he wasn't using a cast of teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a rated R comedy. Believe it or not, this movie is going to, celebrate its, what is it, the 22nd today? In 3 days, it'll be celebrating its 26th birthday.
Wow.
So 26 years ago, almost to the date that we're doing this podcast, wicked exciting for me. Such a great movie. The pairing of John Candy and Steve Martin, John Hughes again, writing and directing. You know, I can't say enough about this movie and the time period from which it came out. You know, I think this movie, outside of the fact that you were saying, you know, with technology, it's timeless. It's just
definitely
a
timeless.
Funny movie and brilliant in the way that it's written. We talked, I think, was it last week? We talked about shortness of movies, right?
Mm-hmm.
This movie's 90 minutes long.
Oh, and it could have been a lot longer.
And it was. Actually.
Theoretically, or the rumor mill has it, that they shot at least 3 hours of footage of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of that footage is somewhere in a Paramount vault.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mishmash of scenes and stuff that they had filled. But listen, 90 minutes, it's in, it's out. John Hughes's expertise in writing, the way that he's able to establish his characters, everybody is identifiable, which makes a great John Hughes movie, or it makes any comedy. You need to identify with somebody in order to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And John Hughes was able to do that in Planes, Trains, 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, Weird Science.
Slew of movies.
Right. It's his slew of movies, but the one thing is it's identifiable. And, you know, between Neil Page, you know, and John Candy's character, Del Griffiths, they're very identifiable. And we were talking about brevity, and this movie sets the pins up, knocks them down, keeps the conflict going, progresses, and before you know it, the movie's over. And you're like, wow, that was a great, it was a great ride. And that we got to go on Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Love it. And right. For the nostalgia reason.
Fantastic. And Cammy, what do you think of this movie? You're a fan as well.
Yes, I'm a fan. I like the movie, I think, too, right now, with it being Thanksgiving, that it's a great time to watch it. The thing is, it came up because, you know, I have children. And what is a good age for them to see it? So, again, I grew up in the 80s. This is an 80s film. I remember it, but I actually thought it was more PG-13. I said, oh, it's R. Am I going to let all my children watch it? My youngest is 10. And so we watched it. And it was just a little bit interesting because I thought there's only really one part in it that I right. found this is why it's R-rated. And, of course, that's when, you know, Steve Martin's character is quite upset and he goes into the rental car.
His tirade.
This goes on, yes.
Says the F word, I believe, 18 times.
18 times uh-huh. within 60 seconds.
Yeah.
And I can almost get that monologue down to a T. Almost have it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, you did that at work. It was great. It was like almost verbatim.
I did it
all.
And I did it over the PA system. No, I can't.
Yeah. So, and Phil, I believe, who hasn't seen this movie, just watched this movie for the first time. Phil, what were your thoughts being a new viewer to this film?
I enjoyed it heavily.
Heavily?
Phil, so. you hadn't seen it. Wow.
Even
this
I
is the first time.
It.
Yeah, okay. I was going to say that the fetus here has even seen it. you haven't seen, you haven't seen it.
Okay, here's the
thing. I'm not. I'm a fan of the
more obscure comedies of all of them, including Lonely Guy. That to me, which is a Steve Martin movie, that to me is hysterical. And. You know, obviously Uncle Buck for John Candy and things like that. So I'm more familiar with that work of theirs than this one. I don't know. I also grew up in a foreign household, so it wasn't like the classic movie. You know, we didn't grow up with that.
Okay.
But I enjoyed it.
Yes, I think this is a very enjoyable movie. And let's just get into how this movie really started. It was based off of John Hughes' real life experience traveling from, I believe it was...
New York to Chicago.
To yeah. Chicago, yeah. And he ended up landing in Wichita, and...
It took him 5 days to get home.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of his movies are based off of something that happened to him, or he was very relatable, but yeah, that's, you know...
That's just... It's quite a story. It's so funny that he... is willing to go into his own personal life. I love writers who are willing to do that kind of and just make fun of their lives and themselves and let people like enjoy with them. Because right. that's what he did. Like you get Steve Martin's line probably 3/4 of the way through being like, well, one day I'm going to look back at this and laugh on it. And that's really what John Hughes is doing yeah. with this movie. He's just laughing at his own life. So I was really happy that it did come from a true story.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm glad how John Hughes took what can seem like a very frustrating few days of his life into a fun comedic time that you can actually enjoy and look back at.
Absolutely.
Right. It also had its sentimental value. Of course, you don't see that during most of the film, but then you find out at the end, you know, John Candy's whole story and, you know, that has a whole Thanksgiving aspect in itself.
Absolutely. Togetherness. But, I'll go again. What John Hughes, to me as a writer, was fantastic on was he was able to... He lent a lot of heart. You look at any one of the movies that he wrote and directed, and, you know, you got to go a little ways back with John Hughes. He started off as a National Lampoon writer, so National Lampoon magazine, and then he went on and he wrote National Lampoon's Vacation, European Vacation, and even Christmas Vacation, which are really a lot of fun movies. But what makes the zaniness work is that he adds heart to his movies, even if it's a rated R movie. There's a lot of heart. And, you know, his teen movies, his 16 Candles, his Breakfast Club, again, identifiable. They all have heart. Some Kind of Wonderful, Pretty in Pink, all of these movies that he wrote, the reason why they work is because they have heart. And he was able to nail that. And even when he was writing for adults, you know, he does something, in my opinion, that's genius in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. You said when we were talking before we started is that John Hughes, that Steve Martin, Neil Page was your identifiable character at the beginning, right?
Yes. I would say that I, especially in traveling, I'm quick to annoyance.
but who here hasn't been part of that where you've been on an airplane, a bus, or whatever, and you get to the airport and you just want to sort of kind of be left alone, right? And then the Del Griffiths pops up and you sort of kind of feel Steve Martin's pain. You identify with him. So, but then something really fascinating happens. They get to the first stop, their hotel room, and Neil Page just has had it. He's at his breaking point and he goes off on Del Griffiths. And then something really crazy happens. Your identifiability goes for leaps from Steve Martin to John Candy to Del Griffiths, because when you talk about heart, that monologue that he says, he goes, you can make fun of me. He goes, go ahead. I'm an easy target. He goes, but I like me. My wife likes me. My customers like me. And all of a sudden you feel like Neil Page, you feel really bad. And then you identify with Del Griffiths. And then now you're identifying with two characters that you're going to be on the rest of this journey with. Mm-hmm. And it makes the movie that much more heartwarming when you get to the end. And it makes that relationship grow. And all of this happens within like 15 minutes of the movie. Mm-hmm. And we talk about brevity. All of this happens. Everything happens very fast. But, you know, you already know your characters. And you know where they're coming from. And that's the genius of John Hughes. Mm-hmm. You know, did you feel, anybody feel the same way, like in that scene?
I did, especially because the point that you made, that it does come so quickly. Like, yeah. So much of this movie, it's like from location to location to location, you're jumping around. But you to build the relationships and the character, right. Relationships and the character while moving so fast between, yeah. Place to place is crazy. And I mean, just to think that this was so much longer and there was so much other footage, it always makes me curious what was in there, because I did get so much out of these characters. Yeah. I did feel connected to them in the very short time that we had.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if anybody else, but I remember watching it in the theaters. God, it was in Revere, Massachusetts, at a Showcase Cinema is where I saw this. But even when you get to the end, you're sort of kind of like, oh, I want a little more. I want to watch them sit and have that dinner. I want to see that conversation. And so that worked. You know, you're right. I mean, you really love these characters. Hello.
And we also have one of our main hosts here, John Comerford, slipping into this podcast. Hello, John. And
I'm situated onto the couch. I don't know if I have
my mic
on.
It is now.
Well, you cannot believe what I've been through to get here.
Planes, trains, and automobiles.
I was grounded. I got rerouted to Wichita. I ended up with my arm cut between two pillows. So that's right.
Yes, yes.
I apologize for my...
Let's hope they weren't a Dimitri's pillow.
Hey, easy on my pillows.
But again, so right now, John, we're talking about how we can identify with these characters.
Uh-huh.
And when we were just talking about Neil going off on Del for the first time, and we can see even in the first 15, 20 minutes before the lead up to that, the first shot we see of Neil at the very beginning, he's already impatient. He's pointing at his watch. You can see he has a destination. He has a deadline to get to.
Sure.
And then so... his impatience and all the things that are happening that just like deter him from his one end goal to get back home on time. You're tripping over Del's trunk, chasing down taxis by Kevin Bacon, which was a nice cameo, especially around that time when Kevin was having Footloose come out and all that. Just so like all these situations. What?
That was off Quicksilver.
Yeah, it was actually a riff off that. And he just finished filming She's Having a Baby. With John Hughes. But again, going back to that, right, I think we may have all been in a situation where we have to catch something to get somewhere and somebody's holding us up. And right? I mean, something is holding us up from getting there, and we have that, and you're looking at the watch, and immediately Neil Page becomes identifiable. And you're like, oh, because it's Thanksgiving. He wants to get home. And, you know, he instantly, and nothing is going right for this guy. Tripping over a thing, racing with this yuppie that, you know, he couldn't get the cab. His cab gets stolen. And, like, you're like, oh, Jesus, this, you know, it's a comedic tragedy of events, comedy tragedy of events. But, you know, and again, when we finally reach that hotel room, the at first you can be sort of kind of annoyed at Del Griffiths for chatting and taking off his socks. Ooh, my dogs are barking today. But then in that one fell swoop, and the way that the scene was written and performed by John Candy, that relatability, then you relate with John Candy and you sympathize with him. And now you've got two characters on board that you got to follow through. And I think that that was the genius of both performance. That's where screenwriting and performance really, shine. It's a little bit of 87 movies magic.
I agree. The acting's so on par with both of these characters because it is a really easy storyline to follow and not much going on. So, but having these two different completely foils to each other, from Neil, who's a very conservative, straight-laced, straight-A kind of guy, who's very, timely. He's very organized, as you can see. And then we see Del, who's very outgoing, that extrovert, and is full of energy and optimism. And then he's also kind of a mess because we saw that hotel room. He just took over that bathroom like crazy. So having these two completely different people literally forced together for 3 days, it was fun to watch and see how they balance off of each other.
They were a great odd couple. Mm-hmm.
Except they do have the commonality of loving their families.
Correct.
Which brings us into why this does, as you said, become a good Thanksgiving movie. Because they do carry that line through the story. They have this love of their wives and this want to be with family or friends. And so carrying that love despite all of their differences of their situations, financial, personality, everything else, they do have that in common. And they bond about it, like about three times.
Absolutely,
in the movie,
they bond through their love of family. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, John. What did you think of these two paired together?
Well, it's classic. I mean, John Hughes obviously, pardon the term, still from the best. I mean, you always put opposites attract, and because there's a conflict and that creates the drama. I gotta say though, that first third of it, it was driving me crazy. I almost wanted to stop because it was just too much an annoyance for me. I didn't see it when it first came out. I don't know if we had talked about that.
I did not see
it when it first came out. Just didn't get a chance to see it. So as I was watching it, I was because first of all,
it started viscerally affecting Hollywood
traffic. I hate all that nonsense. So I was reluctant to watch it at all because it drives me crazy. I can't wait for teleporters so I don't have to go through all that. So I was so with wanting to turn it off, but I didn't when you were saying relate to, I didn't relate to Neil. Only I did in the sense that this guy, this boor who comes into my life is making my life living hell because of who he is and I can't get home. But then he was so mean in that scene that we were just talking about. That I went, I can't see somebody be this mean right now. I just couldn't. But obviously the movie won me over towards the end because you got to see why he was being like he was. But anyway, to answer your question, I didn't relate to either of them, and I almost was ready to turn it off, but I just kept sticking it out because I trusted John Hughes and I trusted these performers. So that's why I hung with it and was pleasantly surprised that I did and was rewarded for that patience.
Yeah.
Well, for my money, I mean, what really works is at the core of this, it's compassion, right? Because it's so easy to identify with Steve Martin's character because why? We all get, quite easily annoyed, more so in today's day and age, and we don't have necessarily compassion for other people. And ultimately, as the movie goes on, yes, they're annoyed with each other and it kind of grows and grows. But at the end of it, they get to know each other and it's like, okay, well, this guy's this way because you know what? His wife died and he really doesn't have anybody else, but we never stop and think about that because it's me first. And I think that's the point of the movie.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I knew I'd just hang with it because you're in the hands of a skillful person writing it.
And I have to say too, because I do remember the first time seeing this movie, and I saw it with my best friend Rick, and it was like the movie's 26 years old in 3 days, and November 25th, and the twist. So you have this Del Griffiths, who's a force of nature, and you're right. And what's great about him, he has friends everywhere. Oh, I have a friend at this hotel. Oh, I have a friend at this airport. He owes me a favor. I have a friend at this. Oh, he owes a truck and whatnot. And that's fantastic. But, when you're building up to it, instantly you're able to, and John Hughes does it so skillfully, he has the picture of his wife. Mm-hmm. But, he loves his wife. He has a picture of it. And it's not till a little bit later on, probably when they get to that moose-type lodge and he can't get a hotel room and he's out in the car, and he has that little monologue where he's talking, well, Marie, you know, I did it again, I blew it again, and you know, and hopefully I'll see you soon. It sort of clicks right there that, oh, his wife is not with us anymore, and mm-hmm. and again, I think it's the performance of John Candy, coupled with that writing, that it's a very touching scene, and it just comes off of funny scene. He is, yes. He's just so sweet, and it comes off that scene where they're trying to get the room, and Steve Martin's like, he's like, here's like, I got $47 in a really nice watch, and the guy's like, he goes, well, I have $2 and a Casio. And
he does the Casio. He does like the hand model. Yeah.
He's like, good night. So, but it, you know, it's a really funny scene. And then, you know, with him just sitting in the car, it's like he doesn't just take a chair inside the lobby. He goes up to that car with his parka and he's having mm-hmm. that touching moment talking to his wife. And then, of course, when Steve Martin opens mm-hmm. the door, he's like, Del, you know, I mean, there were two beds in that room. Yeah. They don't have to worry about the pillows.
Not and like the first hotel room. Right. There was only one bed.
So, again, I think it's just the strength of performance, and I do think it's a strength of John Hughes' writing where he's able to make that work. We're in today, we talk about, you know, we were talking a little bit about brevity. The movie's 90 minutes long.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, you look at a Judd Apatow movie, ugh, comedy. Mm. Those movies, 2.5 hours. You don't need,
because he doesn't believe in editing.
Right. Yeah. And you don't, a comedy doesn't necessarily, unless you're, it's a mad world. Yeah. And that's the only comedy that I can think of that's like 3 hours plus long. Mm-hmm. You don't need to be that long. And Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is in. It's out. It sets the pins up very early on. And then you're off to the races. And by the end, you're like, wow, okay. And just the way that it ends, you wonder, is this a Neil Page movie or is this Del Griffith's movie? Because we start with Neil Page.
No, but now they're one big happy family, so there's neither movie. Right. Come on, that's obviously how it ends.
But yeah, I give it to the pacing because look at all the places that we've been to in 90 minutes. We start off with New York, then we go to Kansas, then we go to St. Louis, and then to Chicago. And that's all within a whole 90 minutes.
90
so,
minutes.
And it just goes to show the pace of, even though it's slow traveling technically, but it's really fast traveling in a movie.
There's no fat on that film.
Well, besides whatsoever. John Candy, but other than that.
Isn't that nice?
You can make fun of him all you want.
John, I love you still. He just called you fat.
Don't mind.
Oh, like he doesn't. Right. Couldn't he had a career because he was fat, for crying out loud.
No, see, but I will, see, I say, you know, it's funny that you brought that up because I was thinking about that. John Candy to me, who is the guy that used to be on Saturday Night
Farley.
Live?
Chris Farley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He had a career because he was fat. I don't think that he was close to the talent that John Candy was. John Candy could play sympathetic, but he didn't have to rely on his girth to be a comedian, to be funny, to be sympathetic. He really was, like, you got that sweetness from him, where I think, like, a Chris Farley, his skits and whatnot work because he was overweight. Like, if he was a skinny guy, that stuff wouldn't be funny, period.
I don't think it was just girth and weight, also. I think it was just they both, Farley and John Candy, they both have outgoing personalities, which everyone can really get along with, and they can enjoy that kind of presence.
Yeah, I put Candy in a much different, I put him in a different class than Chris Farley. I think that Candy is a much more talented, I think he was a much more talented actor, you know. And
well, let's also realize that Chris Farley died way too soon, and we didn't see the body of work.
So did John Candy.
Yeah, but we didn't see the body of work that he could have. I mean, I'm just making these. I mean, listen, John Candy was around a lot longer than Chris Farley. That's all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And he grew into that. He wasn't the greatest of actor when he started out. I mean, he was the fat, funny guy. That's what he was. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. He was great at it. And he became a much better actor the more and more he did these things. We can't be sure how Chris Farley would have been had he been able to live around long. Be around longer. We don't know.
Perhaps, yeah. No, we don't. But we do know, you know, again, we grew up in, at least I grew up, with two television shows in the 70s. They were Saturday Night Live and then Second City Television. So, you know,
you didn't have any others?
Huh?
You didn't have any others?
No, well, I'm talking about comedians. Like, you know, I grew up with, like, John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd. I grew up with that troupe. And then watching Second City Television, which was sort of like, it was the Canadian version of Saturday Night Live, where you had John Candy, and you had Eugene Levy.
Martin Short.
And you know, you had the Canadian.
The Back Bacon Boys.
The Back Bacon. Right. And you know, so these people I sort of kind of grew up with, and when they started to get into movies like John Belushi and John Candy, you know, you took notice. And, you know, John Candy was smart. He picked some good roles. And again, I'll go back to John Hughes and his writing. John Hughes was able to write for certain people just wonderfully. And I had three come to mind. Molly Ringwald, Anthony Michael Hall, and John Candy. When those actresses were in his movies, that's when they really shined.
They blew up.
And he loved to work with them. And, you know, but Candy was one of those actors too. I mean, because Uncle Buck's a great movie.
Great movie.
And you love that movie because of Uncle Buck.
See, and I grew up with John Candy movies, and my dad's into John Candy as well, and I watch a bunch of movies with my father. This is tradition every year with my dad, and we always watch this movie over and over again, so shout out to my dad.
That's awesome.
And so I grew up with John Candy movies like Home Alone, Uncle Buck, and even The Great Outdoors.
This great classic movie,
which is another John Hughes film. Yep. So I just grew up loving John Candy and that outgoing personality, because it does remind me of my dad, so.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I remember John Candy, one of his first movies, it may have been his first, I'm not sure, but he played Tom Hanks' brother in Splash.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was great in that. He had one of the best lines ever, like, when they were on, like, the Cape Cod cruise boat, John Candy used to, throw change down, he used to throw change in the boat so that the women would it would go to bend over to pick it up, and then he'd look up their dresses. So they had a flashback as kids, and then when he's older, he's still doing it. And Tom Hanks is like going, "You're still doing that?" He goes, "Hey, when I find something that works, I stick with it." And it's just a great line. So yeah, growing up with John Candy, when he passed away, for me, it was one of those sad passings.
It was a really sad time. Yeah. And also Steve Martin had a big career back then. I mean, he still does, but back then as well with, you know, The Father of the Bride, and around that time, it was more
the Jerk, 90s. Mm-hmm. But Man the Jerk, with Two Brains, exactly. Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
And Roxanne, the same.
Exactly. And Steve Martin had a hard time with John's passing as well.
Yeah. And actually, Phil's, one of Phil's favorite movies, The Lonely Guy, is a really good.
It's an amazing movie. Definitely check it out. It doesn't get the recognition it deserves.
I agree wholeheartedly.
But actually, you know, you brought up, you know, we keep going back to the writing, and so I want to go back to the writing in the sense of John Hughes. Later in his career, he wrote under an alias.
Yes.
And I thought that was interesting to know, and Dimitri has introduced me to it, that he wrote a script, but it was bad, and then because of it, he wanted to do this. He didn't want to be known under his name of John Hughes. Mm-hmm. Right? Is that?
Yeah. It was basically, it was coming towards, he was having a hard time in Hollywood, and he wasn't really liking the way, you know, he just wasn't liking the whole politics of it all. And he sort of kind of retired. He sort of kind of took himself out of it, and he moved himself back to Chicago, and he actually bought a farm. And he became a farmer. He like literally lived off the land. But
can't really have a farm in Chicago.
It was out in the burbs.
It was outside.
And, but he still needed to make some money, and so he wrote under, which I find is funny, Edmond Dantes, which is a nod to the Count of Monte Cristo.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so he wrote movies like Beethoven, you know, he wrote the sequels.
One and two,
And three. And, you know, he was just writing these not great movies, but just to make a buck, but he stopped directing, and, you know, he just got out of the business altogether, which is sad. You know, I was always hoping that we were going to get one more. His last movie that he wrote and directed himself was Curly Sue. And I always thought that's not exactly the highlight
the
to go out on. And I always thought that, you know, I was always hoping that he would come back and, you know, give us one more movie. But, you know, it was never meant to be for us.
I mean, what is symbolically the name Edmond Dantes? I mean, can we say Count of Monte Cristo? But for those of you unfamiliar with the work, it's a story about revenge.
Exactly.
Which is interesting to know. And, I mean, I guess in that sense, you could be, you could say, did he get his revenge or did he not?
Well, we won't know that because he died before he could, unfortunately. But what's more interesting to me about that story is that he's so obviously a Midwestern guy.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
obviously everything he sets is in Chicago or Midwest.
It's usually in the storyline usually takes place in somewhere in Illinois.
Right. Sherman. Yeah.
But what but that sensibility, which is why I think he had such a hard time in Hollywood, because you just don't swim with the sharks in the Midwest as much. I mean, you have a different sensibility. Even the people who are peppered in this movie, he so has appreciation for the people who live in the Midwest and the kind of people there, and their sensibilities, their likenesses, those kinds of things. And you can see them throughout all his movies, and I can see why he would not go over well. He wouldn't get along well with the entertainment types. Out here.
Yeah. On a farm.
Exactly. You mentioned the Midwest. I'm actually from Illinois, so I think that's why I relate so much to all of John Hughes' films, because I'm from Illinois. I know what that lifestyle is like, and it appeals to me as a person, but I figure with the sentimentality of all of his movies, that appeals to everyone else, but storyline and the locations that all these stories take place in is in Illinois, it's in the Midwest. It's such a relatable lifestyle for me. Yeah. That's why I enjoy John Hughes films.
Yeah. And I think, too, to your point about him being not the Hollywood mold, I mean, he wrote very unorthodoxly as well. He was known as being one of the fastest writers.
Crank it out.
He would, like, write
plays. He took, 3 days?
Three days, apparently.
For this one, it was
like 3 days, but it was literally days that it would take him to write a script. And what I love.
Just the draft. That doesn't mean he doesn't do rewrites.
An interesting thing. His storylines, usually in most movies, only take place over a few days.
Right.
So that might be another reason why.
Yeah, and it's just great because he'll get the idea in his head, and then he goes and writes. And what I found fascinating is after he writes it, he literally reads it. He would have read it out loud to himself to make sure he had the dialogue right. You know, and he did capture the dialogue of the time, of the kids, of the adults. You know, he had a great ear for dialogue. And, you know, I mean, that to me is so the anti what we consider today, because it can take so long to bang out a script. Yeah. Another great story of his.
Phil, can you attest to that?
Yeah, I've been writing mine for 10 years.
Exactly. The other thing I found fascinating about that is he would be on, if there was a, and I can't remember what film it was, but he tells the story about, he was on a film that he wrote and directed. He was having a difficult time getting everything taken care of. It was a really difficult shoot. While that was happening, he's writing another script in 3 to 5 days, getting another one done, saying, okay, I'll do that next. So I don't know how you have any time of the day if you're directing a film. But somehow, because it's going so badly, he just says, I have to do something because
I'm going to write a film maybe even about it.
And I was just going, how the heck? Because I have a hard enough time writing a script when I'm not doing anything else.
Right.
And
but I think that just goes to show the mind of an artist, because usually creative people have a million projects going on in their head. So I think that just attests to the work that he's able to do.
And keep artists in the back of your head for a second, because like a story that's similar to yours is, he was working on Breakfast Club, and Breakfast Club, he thought, okay, I'm going to make Breakfast Club. He already had it all good and done, and you know, he figured the only way he can get it done, it has to be cheap. How do we do this? Oh, detention. Detention at a school, one room.
Yeah.
Most of it, you know, we're going to feed everybody in this room. It's if you watch Breakfast Club, it's primarily in this one room. Well, while doing the casting, he meets Molly Ringwald. And he became so enamored and so inspired. She literally became, in a sense, his muse. He scrapped Breakfast Club and all of a sudden started writing 16 Candles for Molly Ringwald. And that became his first movie. And then he brings her back again in for Breakfast Club. But again, to your point, the mere fact that he could just go, God, Molly.
A new one. Yeah.
You know, an anomaly, man.
And how, like, geez, and for Molly Ringwald at that age, too. Oh, my head. It's he's writing this movie for me. And, her career is owed to John.
To John
so is Anthony Michael Hall's. I mean,
But see, Anthony Michael Hall didn't play it smart. He started arguing with him, and he was out. You know, which is, again, too bad because Anthony Michael Hall with John Hughes worked great. Right. And, you know, I love Weird Science. Mm. You know, I love, you know. Yeah, it's a great movie.
Breakfast Club.
Breakfast
Club.
That's
the one that takes the cake for me. It's always Breakfast Club.
Yeah,
and I love it so much I put it in our intro.
Another rated R movie, too, by the way. And, you know, when people look at Breakfast Club or think of Breakfast Club, you know, the Anthony Michael Hall character, I was thinking about this as I was driving in, you know, it's a pretty dark, Breakfast Club has its dark moments.
Oh,
and,
definitely.
You know, that particular character, you know, he's in detention because he brought a gun to school. Mm. And at that time, those kind of shootings weren't as relevant as they are today. But he didn't bring it in to mow people down. He brought it in because he was going to commit suicide. He just couldn't take that character couldn't take the pressure that his parents and life was putting on him.
But and when that the comes relatable out in the movie, aspects right. of all teenagers
absolutely.
And adults.
Yeah, and John Hughes just got it. And he was able to put it down on paper, write it in 3 days.
And yeah, and that's what John was so good at, to have all these basic storylines that anyone could really relate to here and there. And for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, that basic concept of dealing with the public traffic, especially during holidays. And that's fun to watch.
You guys already discussed that how he wrote that or why he wrote it, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, about him. Yes. Yeah, about him being waylaid, you know, from Chicago. Or from New York to Chicago.
So, and I've actually been fortunate enough to have good experiences at airports, knock on wood, because I'll be flying fairly soon. But just having the frustration of traveling and literally going from planes to a train. Trains are fun, actually. And automobiles. It just, that everyone has to go through that at least once in their life.
Yeah, Cammy, didn't you get stuck with a big fat dog?
What?
Yes, I did on the airline once. They were trying to get a dog about 300 pounds trying to get on the airline.
You're kidding.
I mean, it was a massive dog.
Wow.
And they had like four people picking him up, trying to get him, laying over. The owner, this lady, had purchased three seats, the whole one row. For this dog, but because he was so massive, they picked him up. He didn't even fit in the row. So they take him back out, and she said, well, let him just lie, you know, in front of the exit door. And they said, this is a hazard.
Yeah, you can't.
And after about 30 minutes, they said, we've got to take off. So you've got to take the dog out. And just, you're going to have to rent a van or something and move him.
I'm still waiting for the punchline. This sounds like a joke.
I don't know what happened. They did take her and the dog off. And they said, hey, maybe just rent a van and take him where you need to go.
Or a semi.
Or a semi.
Wow.
Yes. See, and I think that's why you fall in love with this movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, because at first, you see Neil's character, and if it were any of us that's obviously had some kind of tragedy in traveling, you're just, when you see John Candy come in, you're just like, if this were me, I would dump him. I wouldn't keep going on and on. I would just, like, get rid of him. And then the first scene, when it comes to the hotel, and you see that he really is a person and he has a heart, then you start falling in love with him. So that's why you identify with both characters. You understand Steve Martin's frustrations and think, if that were me, could I deal with this guy? And if it were real, I would just want to dump him. And then you realize you're pulling for him, and you're saying, you know, to Steve Martin's character, quickly love this guy like we're loving him as we're watching him, so he can stay with you somehow. You want them to end up together.
Yeah. Well, for Steve Martin, I think in terms of him as an actor, and again, it's a combination of the writing, but I think it's choices by Steve Martin. He almost plays the camera a little bit. You know what I mean? Anytime something happens, like, remember, he pulls out the drying his face, and he thinks it's a towel, but it's not a towel, right? He almost does that look almost into camera, saying, "Hey, you know, you guys get it. You can laugh." Yeah. And I think that's a classic of the time to an extent, but also Steve Martin in general.
It's part of his acting persona. I mean, he's mastered the frustrated shock look.
Uh-huh.
It's a reoccurring theme in his acting. That is one of his prime skills. He can be really frustrated and really shocked simultaneously all the time. Actually, just mentioning Steve Martin, he, acting-wise, he just got an honorary Academy Award at the Governor's Board, and he made a speech, and he did mention this movie. He did thank John Hughes, and this is where he was actually the one who said that,
I think the original script was like 165 yeah. pages.
Yeah,
3 hours long.
Three hours long. And he was like, what are we cutting? And he seemed a little resistant, but obviously that went through.
Did he say it was one of his favorites at some point?
He has. He has said this is one of his favorite films, yeah. which is great because he's made tons. And he's also a writer as well as an actor.
A musician. So. Right. Yeah. You know, I mean, Steve Martin's career, it goes back to Disney.
Did you guys also read that one of the reasons why he chose to do the film was because of the tirade?
Yeah.
Okay.
The tirade.
I just learned that recently. I didn't know.
Yeah, it was the rental car tirade and the scene with the two of them in the car.
And if not for that scene, it probably would have been a PG movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
This movie is actually PG in a few countries.
Really?
Besides U.S., because U.S. has that limit of how many swear words. How many can say?
You can't say 18?
You can't say 18 in one minute.
One time, and it needs to be R. But I'm wondering, because it is 26 years old, what would the rating be today on that? Because I do think it's a good film.
Only because of that F-bomb.
No, if it were today, they would have, the studio would have come down and the writer-director and say, take that scene out. They would have said, take it out.
Or they would have just
They would have maybe had him say something else, or they just take it out completely.
So they wouldn't give it a PG-13.
To give it a PG-13.
The rating would be an R because of
it would be a rated R.
And I almost find it sad that it's rated R because I think it's such a family film.
That's my point.
I think this is where you want to sit down with your children for Thanksgiving. It has a great meaning. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, when we were just watching this, I let all the kids watch it. And it was just that one scene, right? But it had to be in there to really give you the feeling of, because as you said, too, you were ready to just shut it off because you're so frustrated he's even putting up with this. So they needed that in there to give the audience the frustration.
The release, in general.
It is a release because when I was a kid watching this, my parents always said, all right, leave the room for about 2 minutes. And then I finally understood why once I was older. But after the scene, after his whole tirade and the F-bombs and stuff, and the next time he's with Del, you can see him finally, like, accept everything that's going on. And it actually warms up and open and more welcoming to Del after just, like, letting it all go.
Yeah. And you have to, again, I'll take it, you know, again, because I do remember, okay, back in 1987, you know, R wasn't the taboo that it sort of kind of is today. Like, it wasn't necessarily a bad thing to release an R-rated movie.
Going for the tweens as much.
But movies were still, movies still made money. A lot of money is being R. But that one scene was so, because of that frustration, it was so riotous in the theater. It's just one of those things where the theater was roaring, to my recollection, because he just went off. And I'm going to say it. That scene is not only great because of his performance, but it's funny because of the word fuck. I mean, that is a funny, it's a funny word in the way in which he says it. And he mouths it and makes sure that it's enunciated.
Just choose
that. It also helps when you're saying it to Edie McClure.
Exactly.
Got a cherubic face.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, the person he's ranting to, like, the such bubbly, another bubbly extrovert kind of person who's kind of...
And Phil and I were talking...
I hate those effing people because, okay, you have a job to do.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she's talking on the phone.
And she's talking about Thanksgiving, what she's going to do. He's even more frustrated. And I think that's why it comes out. It was icing on the cake for him.
We've all been there when it comes to customer service, whether it's a rental car, whether we're trying to make an exchange at Best Buy or something, and that person is on the phone or the cashier is, like, not paying attention to you, and you're like, and Phil and I were talking about this. Again, very relatable. And we've all been in a situation.
We've all wanted to say that.
Correct. But we've been in that situation, way, shape, or form.
And I think at the ending of all of that, it was such a payoff with that clerk saying, you're fucked. So it just goes to show how contagious Neil's attitude is. He brings out the worst in people. Even this happy-go-lucky clerk person who was just happy 2 minutes ago, and after that, gets to the point where she says that to him.
And she gets the ultimate revenge. Yeah, exactly. And again, I'll go back to John Hughes' writing. He knew how to set up a joke and a punchline. Mm-hmm. And that scene is a joke. And it's a punch. I mean, there's the punchline.
But don't you find it fascinating, going to Cammy's point, that would they make that, or how would they rate that this day? Because the idea that that one scene would take your movie from a PG to an R, mm-hmm. and the money you would lose today right. by doing so, or not even be able to because the studio wouldn't let you because of the money you would lose, is kind of shocking to me.
Yeah.
That it's so silly, in a sense, because that for the in context, it's hysterical and should be acceptable. And even though you were sent out of the room, were you okay with having everybody see it?
I hit mute for that 1 minute. Yeah. Okay. But it's only because my 10-year-old was there.
But if your 15-year-old was there,
yeah, they
be
were. Out? Yeah, the 13 and 14-year-old were there. But I hit mute for the 10-year-old. They were so into the movie, they right. kept saying, "Okay, take it off mute. Take it off mute." It was a long minute. Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, the scene itself is a minute. It's a minute. Right. It's like a mute for a minute.
But it's a long minute, but they're all sitting there looking, reading the lips because it's so clear and precise. Exactly.
And you're like,
And the question is, had the 10-year-old not been in the room, would you have muted it?
Probably not. I mean, I do think PG-13 is a good rating from that scene.
Too. Exactly.
But the other thing is, I do think it's a family film. Again, I'm going back to that. So I hate for the children to miss out, and really that was the only scene I feel that might be a little, mm-hmm. you know, for not underage children.
It is the only scene that you would have to be concerned about.
Exactly.
But you say a family film, so, you know, you had no problem with going, oh, okay, you want me to, I'll point out one of your problems. You scratch your balls. You scratch your balls, you have more balls.
Hey, what 10-year-old isn't doing that anyway?
Oh, exactly.
Okay?
Yeah, I had no problem with scratching the balls.
You know what I need?
Yeah,
an extra pair of
balls.
Yeah, she has three boys.
I have three boys.
Yeah, she doesn't have a problem with it.
No, and my husband, and they're all scratching their balls.
There you go.
So I have no problem
with
that.
Hey, speaking of which, Dimitri, put your hands on the table, please. So.
He found some pillows.
But there, yes, exactly. There were a lot of great moments.
Yes.
Just for the adults who are watching this, it was that ode to the adults so they can enjoy this movie. The whole tirade, and even that the hotel when they both wake up together, and those aren't pillows.
Those are pillows. How about the Bears?
How about the Bears game? Again, like Illinois humor.
Yeah.
The football is like, just after the, manly be like, grunting.
They're going to make it into the playoffs. Just walk.
So, a lot of great adult moments. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's nothing offensive about that movie.
No.
And again, you have that minute.
Just when he takes his shoes and socks off. That's
offensive. My God, that was
very offensive.
Or he's washing his face with them, right?
Yeah,
actually, there's a lot of offensive things in this movie.
But not, I'm saying.
Maybe not rating wise, but.
But again, if we compare this to a Hangover. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, this movie.
Well, but you're talking 20 years later. Everybody has to push the envelope like crazy.
No, I understand. Yeah. And that's why going back, 1987, and a little later, I really want to talk about the differences of movies mm-hmm. and grosses mm-hmm. and release patterns. But in 1987, to come up with, it wasn't too much of a shock that this movie was rated R. And, and for a good reason. And today, the movie with that scene in it is still rated R because of the amount of fucks in there.
Mm-hmm.
But today, executives would they wouldn't allow it.
No.
They would say, take it out.
No,
and I think that would be one of the things that would have frustrated John Hughes to no end
mm-hmm.
because he knows that scene works. And
Steve mm-hmm. Martin wouldn't have done the movie.
He wouldn't have done the movie. He wouldn't have done the movie.
I think that's great. I'll do it if you keep that in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you might need star power like that at the time to have it.
It'd be a completely different movie if Steve Martin wasn't in it.
Yeah.
Oh.
I think if either one of them. I don't know if either one of them weren't in that movie, I'm not sure, who you could have replaced them with. So, in that scene alone too, it's I wonder though today if you got comparable
to see Aykroyd and Belushi in it, that would have been interesting.
That would have been Yeah, it would have been.
Also big names back in that time as well.
Well, who today? If you were to make that movie today, right?
Well, they did. It's called Due Date.
It's called...
That's what I said.
That movie was horrible.
It was terrible.
Awful.
I watched Due Date and
that movie
was
made me
so
angry.
Upset because I am so in love with this film. I'm like, that was a complete ripoff, and then you modernized it to today's society, and I just didn't care for it.
You didn't? Well, more to the point, you didn't care for any of those characters.
No.
There was nothing relatable. Robert Downey Jr.'s character was so mean, and he never really changed. And Zach Galifianakis's character was so annoying. Mm-hmm. Like, again, there was no... unrelatable. Mm-hmm. It went on for way too long. Yeah. And I think that
Did
was...
Judd direct that one?
He might... It was... I think it was one of his... He may have produced it or something. Or was directed... Yeah, I think he had a hand in there, but it was not a good movie at all. Made me angry.
Todd Phillips directed it.
Todd Phillips.
There you go.
It made me angry watching that movie. No,
that's what the computer's here for.
Okay. Nice. Yes, thank you, Sarah. But let's try to get into some of the cinematography. We know the storyline takes place from New York, mostly in Illinois, but they shot some places in Illinois, like Kankakee and Gurnee and some hotels.
In California.
And, the interior studios. Well,
a lot of the highway shots.
The highway shots were in California.
And I believe they also shot in New York as well, outside. And I was watching this movie again a couple days ago, and I'm like, that is so what Illinois looks like. Because I come from the Midwest, like smack dab in Illinois. It's all corn and fields, and being on a highway for miles and miles, that's all you get is land. Yeah. It's like there's nothing.
Well, I think there's a shot too of the St. Louis airport when they're there, isn't that? Mm-hmm. Actually, yes, the in St. Louis a little bit there.
And there's the shot with the airplane flying in the sky. Right. I went, wait a minute, wait, I know that. What is that from? And I found out later what it was.
Yeah, they stole it from another movie.
Yeah, they
stole
it from Airplane.
Airplane.
It was great.
Well, I thought it was interesting just how when approaching companies to do this film, no one would do
Nobody would do it because they were like,
no, this is bad publicity. So they had to rent all their own rental cars. They couldn't use a rental car company. They couldn't use the plane company. They had to do all of this stuff themselves and spend so much of their budget on just that alone. Because everyone's like, No, this is bad PR.
This bad, yeah.
But I can understand that when you're having a tirade against one of the rental car employees, no one would probably want to put a name on that.
I would run, I'd say, you want? Absolutely, we're in. What do you want?
Free advertisement.
Not only that, but you could say, if you want us to do it, help us out here. Because you don't have to look like the bad guy the entire time.
Right.
Because they don't, really. Because when he goes off on it, she doesn't look like a bad...
And in the situations, like in the flights and everything, it's not their fault. It's all blamed on the weather.
Well,
I would have said yes.
Absolutely. Speaking of which, Ferris Bueller's teacher there.
Yeah.
What's that guy's name?
Ben Stein's the actor.
Okay, so Ben Stein at the airport.
Cameos.
Bueller.
Yeah.
Cameos.
Nowhere. Yeah, Destination Nowhere. That's awesome. You know, all the flights are canceled. And then he smiles.
Yeah.
He's like, you're stuck here. But I just love in the background, it says Destination Nowhere. So, yeah.
This is where this film is going.
Yep.
Who knows?
You know, and speaking of cinematography, I mean, the guy that was the DP, the cinematographer on this, his name is Donald Peterman. And this guy had been around, and in fact, he did Adam's Family Values. I don't know, Phil, I know you're a big Adam's Family fan.
Heck yeah.
All right.
Keeping it PG.
Yeah, and he also, you know, there are some Star Trek connections here. He also did Star Trek for The Voyage Home, and he also did Cocoon, Splash. We talked about Splash. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy's been around. He did Men in Black, Get Shorty. Wow. You know, and How the Grinch Who Stole Christmas.
So he's worked,
and he's worked with good directors throughout. And you know, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles does have a look.
Yes, it does.
And again, looks that are like you said, that's Illinois, and you can point that out.
It really is, because I just come from there, and I just know what Illinois looks like. It's all landmass. If there's Chicago, than cornfields. That's it. But I gotta admit the interior shots and whatnot. I believe because of the weather locations that they were waiting out the weather just so it can have more snow and stuff. But so they shot a lot of the hotel scenes together. It was fun. Like literally the small cramped areas, and then having these two big, loud, boisterous guys together in the same room really added to the movie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the home that Neil Page lived in, I believe it was an interesting story about that because they actually built that on a set and it cost, you know, and John Hughes wanted I want the home. And apparently it cost then $100,000, but apparently Paramount was really upset.
Yeah,
pissed.
I can't see why. I mean, yeah. $100,000 for something that you shoot a couple of scenes.
Well, but don't, for, but,
that
but don't
for, like,
forget.
All of our extra footage was.
Yeah. Don't right. forget the movie at that point. There had been a lot of film. So they were probably going, what for a comedy? 3 hours? What? Yeah. So
but the funny thing is the situations that they're always, they're literally right next to each other, stuck yeah. together in yeah. cars, in buses, in the hotel rooms, and trains. Like they're literally shoulder to shoulder constantly. They yeah. can't separate, even though Neil tries to get
and then
rid
they
of
also,
Del.
They have
times.
The big trunk.
The big trunk
that they're
oh, yeah.
always they got to carry. They get off the train. Yeah. And,
it's a metaphor
know.
For all the baggage we carry.
Exactly.
Around.
Of course. Yes.
Yeah, it's like the briefcase in Pulp Fiction. We never yeah, know we what's never inside.
Yeah.
You know, but we know that it's heavy.
Then obviously, it was you know shower curtain rings.
Shower curtain rings.
That was great.
What else could it have been? Well, that's how he made all those friends. That's
right.
He sold all those earrings. I mean,
the autographed Walter Cronkite edition. Yes. Where's the autograph?
Something from like the Emperor of China. Or something.
In the montage mm-hmm. when Del's awesome. Selling all those rings and even to the,
this
the,
one's filled with
the three girls yeah, to the three teenagers like you could pass for 18
yeah,
19
you look older.
They just
yeah.
hand over
the money.
I'm like oh they're so smart and mm-hmm. such a business salesman
yeah.
and he uses his personality to even gain more friends
right.
and yeah. everywhere
absolutely.
He goes
absolutely.
Mm-hmm. That was the only shocker for me throughout the entire movie. I was so convinced that he was going to be able to talk himself out of that ticket or like
yeah.
talk himself into just getting the car. Because I'm like, he's a great salesman. I believe in him at this point.
I thought
get money
that,
out
I
of
thought
anything.
Eventually he was going to know him.
Oh,
right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
yeah. he knows
hello,
everybody.
Officer.
Has
what can we help you
the
with?
The only shocker of the whole movie. Yeah. So I was just like, what?
He didn't talk
and, how did that happen?
And it's another great John Candy who's like, do you really feel that this car is street legal?
I do.
Yes, I do.
The
yeah.
radio works.
Is there
and
the
even
radio works.
It's all you need.
Yeah, even that like crazy because the car is basically useless, but the only thing that works is the radio.
Hey, am I the only one that looked like before the car went through its disarray? I always looked at that car. It looks like a shorter version of the family truckster. From Vacation. It had the same wood paneling. It was that green color. I don't know.
I'd have to look it up more. I know that the car, in general, they had to do
it
some adjustments.
It was a mishmash, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They compiled a few vehicles into yeah. one.
Well, look at you.
Yeah, obviously, because there's electronic seat on one side, but the manual
yeah, no,
seat on the other. Is that,
yeah.
How does that happen?
Right.
It happens so that he can get stuck.
Yeah.
And so that they can break the seat.
And again, another great scene. You're going the wrong way. How do they know which way we're going? You're right. How do they know which way we're going? Yeah.
And yeah, that's even Del yeah. Griffith's fun, crazy, and you know, Neil being like, how did I get stuck with this guy?
Yeah. Yeah. And then he's like, yeah, how do they know where we're going? It's just the movie is just chock full of comedic gems and scenes mm-hmm. and dialogue. That you're right. We don't get this today. It's not that kind of writing. I think that there's not the brevity. They don't, or sometimes they'll take too much time to build up a character, but not in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Yeah. You know?
My question is, do you think had this movie been released, the exact same format in today's time, in like present day, like nowadays, or even a few months ago or a few years ago, do you think it would have gained the audience that it did and had that, you know, love for this movie that it did back in the 80s?
I don't think there's a culture for it.
Yeah.
I mean, look what's coming out right now. There's no real Thanksgiving movie. It's Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. No offense to Hunger Games.
No. Yeah. And I think to your point, what you said earlier, you know, part of the charm of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles and being stuck like that, there was no technology. Mm-hmm. You know, go ahead.
Well, I think that there's obviously some big difference that would change, like, the plot and make the plot not understandable, which are the, like, technological elements. I do think it does speak to the fact that so much of society acts kind of more like a Steve Martin character. Like, everyone yeah. wants an immediacy and to get things right away, and there's a lack of patience. And even in this movie, when you see him and he's talking about, oh, well, he's proud of his town. There aren't that many people who are right. proud of your town. I think that message is very, like, good for people to hear now. So while it might not do good in theaters, I think that would be more because of just time. But I think people will relate to it now if they watch it now.
Well, I also think that this movie has two main characters in the 90 minutes. You don't see a lot. You see, you know, brief interactions here and there with the people along the way, but it's really two main characters. How many movies are released today that you're only going to have two main characters? I mean, that is a little bit difficult to draw an audience in there. Who are you appealing to? And who would play the characters as well? I don't think this movie may have done as well today.
They do a lot of one character movies.
Yeah, you have that one main protagonist that everyone roots
normally
for.
They're like about to die, but
but folks, I think we think we answered our own question like 5 minutes ago.
What's that?
Due date.
Yeah,
you know, I mean
just one. I mean, I absolutely think this movie could be successful this time. It would depend obviously on who wrote it and who directed it and who's in it. But I mean, because you can make anything as long as it was made well. Yeah. I think you would have an audience for it. Okay, due date, as you say, was not.
Right.
Yes, Phil?
Yeah, okay, Phil. So Zach Galifianakis, is kind of in that role of John Candy, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Seth Rogen.
But he doesn't have as broad of an appeal that Candy did. That's my...
I don't think that there's anyone really who fits the John Candy image right now. Can't picture anyone. I think that he's just so lovable.
Yeah.
He's guileless too. He doesn't have really an agenda everybody else has. He's an just edge such, or an agenda.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Lovable, and I don't know who I can think of that has that right now.
Also, I mean, there's a cartooniness, right? Meaning, well, we haven't talked about it yet, but the sound effects, right? Mm-hmm. This was before Seinfeld and things like that, and it's reminiscent, obviously, Bueller's Day Off, where these moments are just heightened. By just the weirdest things, whether music or an actual sound effect, and you laugh because of it. And we don't get that anymore.
Yeah, no, you're right. And
I agree.
John Hughes used that a lot. When you said sound effect, this just popped into my head was, there's a great scene, just like, there's this great scene in Uncle Buck where there's a party and the drunken clown shows up at the door and Buck answers the door and he's like, "Hey, you're drunk. You know, you're not going to perform." And then the clown guy goes, "Oh, you can't tell me, you fat flush and sacka." And then Candy just punches him in the nose. Yeah. And he does that blah, 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 blah sound effect that, again, only John Hughes would use. And again, that slapstickiness, it works. Like, he gets it. And I think it was a product of his growing up. He probably watched those cartoons, obviously.
And those laughs do come. I'm sorry. The sound effects and the music.
The music.
That goes from, like, transitions from place to location to location. There's that one point when the two are on the bus. And Neil sings Three Coins in a Fountain. No one knows that one. And everyone just looks at him like, "What are you singing?" And then you see Del having that, again, outgoing personality. He sings Flintstones. Everyone
knows how to relate.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And then when they're finally in the melted car singing, they're both singing the same song at the hotel. It just goes to show that at one point they were so different, but now they're on the same level and understanding of each other.
Yeah.
Come on, Neil. You must know a song.
Oh, I'm just going to nod to the fact that he does include those slapstick or the very obvious jokes, like him falling over the trunk twice in the same movie, but he makes it funny and keeps it in.
Well, we even have a punch in the face, too, without not a different sound effect, though, but which is a visual of
that. So. And of course, the cab scene, where he goes to pick him up, because I've never seen anybody be picked up by their testicles before. And he's like, "Oh," and he's talking.
Oh, and his voice
goes on and on.
His voice was classic. It was like he sucked the 20-pound helium balloon. It was all, but again, charm, hysterical, it works. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very funny.
And then there was another moment when when they're at the first hotel, and then they get picked up by that crazy son.
Right.
And you can see him, he's chewing.
Dylan Baker.
Yes. You can see him chewing and spitting, even the sound effects. Right. And then when Neil goes to grab his hand, he literally just spit into his hand, and then he's shaking it.
That's how you got to the humor. I don't know if that's the casting, that's Hutchinson or Jenkins, or if it's in concert with Hughes, but whoever put it together. The casting was amazing. I thought the cameos were just terrific. Especially Dylan Baker just killed me.
Dylan Baker was
just I didn't know he was in it, and I'm seeing them. I'm going, wait a minute,
Dylan Baker.
Oh my god, that's Dylan Baker.
And even his character, he was only in it for a minute, and the way he stands and acts, and he calls out his wife.
His wife. Yeah. Look at that.
Like, she didn't even cry. None. Baby came out sideways.
Yeah.
So it's just all these different characters that we see in such a short amount of time. It's still fun to watch.
Yeah, and it's and was that the truck they're in with the dog?
Yes.
And what's
and
great,
they're frozen.
And again, it's the setup and the punchline. Yep. When they get to where they are, they're all frozen. Oh. And then he has to cut to the dog, who's also frozen in that growl. It just works.
And Neil didn't have his gloves because he forgot it at the beginning of the movie. And he goes to grab, and then the dog comes out. That was fun.
Ooh, just missed me. Just nipped.
Just a little bit. But to add to the humor, the fun music, there were moments where there was instrumental and then them actually singing. And then near the end of the movie, we even hear a cover of Every Time You Go Away. So it just goes to show, like, all the different music that they used.
I really loved the moment right before we see them in bed together. That music, that transition music was great because it... I don't know. I don't remember what the song was. I just remember as I was listening to it, I was laughing at the song before I even saw them lying on the bed together.
So was it the anybody
remember? Pulls You In?
That song?
I honestly don't know. I can't remember. But I as it was happening, I was laughing. I better write this down because I'm going to want to talk about it.
Phil, was there a scene
that you specifically wanted to study?
No, this is where Sarah loves her. She loves
I mean,
her
I feel like
studies.
We've kind of talked about half of the scenes. Oh,
yeah, John, go.
When Steve Martin puts it all together, when he's remembering his time with them, and then he starts to realize, wait a minute, there's more going on here.
There's a very interesting twist in that montage. You don't expect it or see it coming.
And why I think it snuck up on the character, too, which is why I liked it so much, because until then he was so hell-bent. Neil, I'm talking about the character Neil, is so hell-bent on either getting away or getting home or just... You know, trying to get away from this person. He doesn't really see him as a whole, complete person that might have a pain in his life or a full experience as a human until he stops and is away from it all and it starts to put it together.
Yeah.
And then he starts to look at it completely differently. And I love that scene for that reason, is because you could see him come to the realization that, oh my God, this man has nobody. And I am his only family.
Yeah, exactly, because during that whole montage scene at the end at the Blue Line CTA, I know what that's like. I go to the CTA in Chicago every other day. But, yes, that realization, the way that they also edited it.
Absolutely.
At first, you can see Neil's character thinking about his home being and having that Thanksgiving food and being with his family. And then going back to his moments with Del and all the traveling places and then what Del's saying, all these little lines that were thrown in throughout the movie that we don't really think about until you put it together.
Yeah.
So it goes from Neil's family to the realization that Del has no family and no home.
Yeah,
well,
I haven't been
and
home
it goes
in
through the process of also, oh, now I have a friend. Like, I've officially made a friend. And then the curiosity about his life really comes through.
And what's funny, and I think another strength of the script is the breadcrumbs are laid down for us to figure this out. Because, again, there's the scene when they're at the diner and... you know, Del lets out, oh, I haven't been home in years. And he's like, seriously? He goes, no. It's just a figure of speech. And then the scene where, well, Marie, I did it again. You know, you're right. I just talk, you know, I blow it with people and I do too much. And you sort of kind of, and he says, you know, hopefully I'll see you, you know, I'll see you soon. And you know, again, that's a thing that she's no longer with us. And
I just thought they were divorced, to be honest with you, until I learned that she wasn't.
I thought it was very realistic for John Hughes to, like, not have him be the one to admit it.
Yeah.
Not perhaps him bring that to light. Right. Or like, because that's something people really do. Like when they experience tragedy, they don't go blubbering to strangers, especially when he's such a happy,
persona. Yeah. Like, so that it came through Steve Martin's realization and his character, like, really completing his, like, arc.
Right.
It's a very good choice.
But well, Neil went through, you know, all the transition all along the way. He was frustrated, then he tried to be kind to him. Yeah. Then he was frustrated, then he was paying for the hotel, doing this back and forth. But at the last scene when they go to that hotel and, you know, he has a little bit of money and a nice watch and the guy takes it and he leaves John Candy on his own and he doesn't have that. Well, then when he looks out the window, sees John Candy sitting in the car, it's just this moment where he really starts to care for him, feel for him, not intentionally wanting to be mean. And then as it goes on, he goes out there. But then the next scene when they're leaving that morning, you know, they're almost in cahoots together now, you know, like bandits trying to get the car that's stranded and they're going back and forth and, you know, ended up going through the hotel room and then taking off. And it was just at that time, I think he realizes that, you know, he's a person and almost loves him on like a brotherly level.
And they had that great bonding scene. Like, where do you want to go now? Oh, there's Mexico in there. Yep. Here's a tequila. And they're, you know, when they get drunk together, it's a great, you know, again, it's another great bonding scene that happens. And to your point, Cammy, it's when they are in cahoots together at that point. Their mission is to get home. Yeah.
And we can see Neil have
created a misdemeanor. But
we can see Neil throughout this movie. He has a character arc and growth because he starts as a frustrated person who doesn't want anything to do with him. And then coming back to Del at the end of the movie, he wants to help him out and have a family. So we see that progression in growth in him.
By the end of it, he introduces Del as his friend.
To his family, to his kids, to his wife.
And you can tell, you know, what works too about that scene. The woman who plays the wife, like, she was really...
Layla Robbins.
I mean, she's not in the movie all that much, but she has a great line, you know? It's like, honey, I'd like to introduce you to my friend Del Grosso. She goes, I've heard a lot about you, Mr. Griffiths, or something to that effect. Yeah,
it's nice to meet you, Mr. Griffiths. It's just that she greets him as a human.
And the way that, again, that it stops, we start the movie off with Neil Page, but it ends up on a freeze frame of John Candy's smiling, chaberic face. And you just get the... You get the warmth. You get welled up, and it's just like...
He has a family. And I loved how throughout the movie, they cut back to the family every once in a while just to reinforce the fact that this is his destination. He's wanting to get home.
Yeah.
So
I'm welling up right now just thinking about it.
Well, that's why I think it's a great holiday film. I think it's a great family film for everyone because it does have a lot of truth and meaning. You're frustrated every day on certain levels, but do we take the time out to really... you know, care for others and get to know them. And it was really heartwarming at the end.
Yes.
That's why I wish, I would have loved to have been at that dinner. I would have loved to have been at that Thanksgiving dinner. You know,
everyone would just have a whole new set of shower rings. That's what would happen.
Yeah, but
that
can you imagine?
That would never break.
The pig pen he would drag through that thing. Napkins here, stuff there. Exactly. That poor house would be demolished with 2 days of him living there. Mm-hmm. Staying there.
My next scene I want to talk about is them in the car and on the highway getting back to from St. Louis to Chicago, them traveling at night. That was hysterical. Probably my favorite scene throughout the movie is just them two. You can see they start off frustrated, and then John Candy, you know, he's so
doing
funny.
The mess around.
Yes, how fun Del Griffith is. And he gets stuck with both of his hands on the side of the and hilarious. Driving the car with his legs. Yeah. And he's smoking, blows, and the car gets fired. There, like, all the things that happen, like, in a matter of minutes, like, he turns the car around. Oh, yeah.
He's a figurative and literal train wreck is what he is.
Exactly. Okay. He's a force of nature. And
we almost hit a deer.
Going back again, like, that is, again, I'm not entirely, I mean, that's slapstick in a sense. It's very slapstick the way, you know, when they're going in between the two trucks.
Yeah, and their faces. And they cut. And the quick flash that, oh my God, he's going to kill me. And then we see Del, like, for a quick second, dressed up like the devil. Like, laughing. That was funny.
And then the two of them sitting on the trunk with their back to the car, and there's a great sound effect. It's like, is that the car? The car's on fire, and they just start laughing.
And that for a scene for me harkens way back to silent movies, because nothing needs to be said. That just the look, the timing of it, they both, one looks, then the other, then they both look, then they both get up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All of that with just it happening in the background. I thought it was great.
And now they're both just laughing at the end of it. Like, after everything they've been through, all they can do is laugh.
What else could happen?
What else could happen? Yeah.
Oh, but there can be more.
And again, that goes to, like, when you look at, we talk about editing and John Hughes and the pacing of the movie is just perfect. Like, there's not an ounce of fat, and he's able to put in so many gags and or jokes that are, and pretty much all of them work. They take you to the end of the movie where you have that very heartwarming feel. And, you know, we talked about the editing of that montage at the end on the train, which is, mm-hmm. you know, to your point, when Neil Page pieces that together and it works so well, and part of it is because of that montage scene, you know, and it was in the hands of a guy, his name was Phil Hirsch, who did the editing, and this guy too. This guy worked on the Star Wars movies. You know, he worked on Star Wars, the first movie, not episode 4. I just call it Star Wars. He worked on Empire Strikes Back. He's worked with the Black Stallion Returns. He did Footloose, so he's worked with Kevin Bacon. Mm-hmm. You know, he did Mission Impossible, so he's worked with Brian De Palma. He worked on Blowout, which is one of the best edited movies out there.
Big movies.
I mean, he's worked on great movies.
Paul Hirsch, I think.
Paul Hirsch.
Yeah. I thought I heard you say Phil. I just don't want you to get letters.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll get letters, but at least they're watching.
Yeah.
So, you know, John Hughes, like, surrounded himself with some talented people. And, you know, it's funny when he talked about, again, just going back. Yeah, he wasn't the Hollywood type. When he never had directed a movie before. And he was saying, I yelled action, and the cameras weren't even on yet.
Yeah. Break up.
So, you know, and it was good on him, because he knew if he was going to make this work, you can always tell. You surround yourself with good people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that it's a philosophy.
Well, you better in a collaborative effort.
That's yeah, absolutely.
Sure. And good writing as well.
And a lot of passion. I think that was the main thing. He had so much passion for this movie.
Yeah.
I mean.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm specifically thinking, I know that there was an interview that he did write about, John Hughes was basically pitched this movie in an interview. He just started acting out the whole thing. I think it comes from the fact that he, like, wrote it all in 3 days and just knew it so well.
Yeah.
But instead of just saying, oh, I'm doing this movie, you know, people get lost, he, like, fully
acted. In an interview?
Yeah, that's or like great. With a publicist or something. I have it somewhere.
That's terrific. I had not heard that.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
He went through the whole thing, like, with full actions.
Wow.
He, like, pulled out all the stops. Mm-hmm. But just from, and that just shows his passion, and that's what makes it work. Yeah. A lot of people who are dedicated and talented, but really being in the heart of your movie.
And mm-hmm. he really stuck, I appreciate too that he stuck to his guns on, you know, and
on the tirade scene, but he just kept it.
Yeah, well, you know, but it's funny, we were talking about this being a 3-hour movie. John Hughes shot over 600,000 feet, or 180,000 meters
of
film.
Which is a lot.
That's a lot.
Especially a 90-minute film. That's almost twice.
Yeah, there was no digital back then. So, you know, for a film back then, you know, that's crazy.
It's
but
like Penny Marshall does the same thing.
I feel like if you have that much, you could just take a role and be like, I don't remember doing any of this.
You know, if Paramount were... I don't know. Apparently, the rumor has it, or the legend has it, that all of this footage is in a Paramount vault. And it's all, it's not...
So we can have a mishmash. Sequel.
Well, we could have a sequel. But, I mean, I don't know. I think it would be interesting. According to this, it says, film does indeed exist, although not in order.
Uh-huh.
Moreover, it's a mess of footage that would take months, maybe even years, according to Hughes, to transform it into an actual film.
It'll be trucks, boats, and wagons.
And it's locked away in this vault. But I don't know. To me, look, the movie to me is perfect as is. It doesn't need to be a 3-hour movie. However, like it would sort of kind of be fun if, like, say, on a 30th anniversary, you release the movie as is. No, hear me out. Mm-hmm. And then if you have some of that B-roll footage, just have it as deleted scenes, just so that we can see.
Sure.
It, because there is a great scene that you can find now. Okay. You can find it on YouTube.
Okay, but let me show of hands here. I usually watch the deleted scenes.
Sure.
You can see why they're deleted. There's a big reason why they're deleted. So, but does anybody does everybody feel that way, or am I the only guy?
Some of them,
yes. I would say 75%. Yeah,
that's a good, you know. But there is a great deleted scene that's on the Blu-ray,
yeah,
actually, and I think you can find it on YouTube, where they're on the plane. Okay, if you notice when they were first on the plane, there's that great old guy character actor that's sitting next to them.
Oh, sitting right next to them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, why aren't they using that guy?
Yeah, well, they did. There's a scene where they're eating. Or they're getting the food, and Dell is like, oh, I just love the food on the plane. And he's like, oh, this is just, like, great. And Neil Page opens up this thing, and it's, like, this lasagna.
Yeah, it looks
like a hockey puck. And he goes to Dell, he goes, what do you think this was? He goes, I think 7 hours ago it was lasagna. He goes, but with all the delays and they nuked it, he goes, you're going to eat that? He goes, no. And so Dell takes it, and then he goes to the old guy. He goes, hey, you want his roll? He's not going to eat his roll. You want his roll? He goes, yeah, all right, I'll have his roll. He goes, how about your brownie? You going to eat your brownie? And Neil's like, I'm going to have my brownie. He goes, oh, I was trying to get you the brownie. He goes, but he's not going to part with it. And then in the same scene, like right over the chair, this huge wave of hair into Neil Page's tray.
No.
And he's sitting there, and you're like going, oh, good God. And then, like, they move it up, and John Candy takes the brownie from the hair, and he's like, you sure you don't want it? He goes, you don't want your brownie? He goes, I don't want it. And he goes to the old guy, he goes, you want brownie? And the guy's like, yeah, I'll take brownie. He goes, good, I'll cut it in half. He goes, here, I gave you the big piece. And again, it's a funny scene. Did it need to be in the movie? No. Probably not, but no, I would... You know, if that scene's funny, I'm willing to bet that there are a couple
I'm
of
sure
other
scenes. I'm sure there's some very good laughs.
Yeah, the Michael McKean scene apparently went on
yeah,
for a
I'm
long time,
Yeah, I'm saying, why?
Too.
As I'm watching, I'm going, okay, they must have cut some of that, because don't get Michael McKean out just for that.
Yeah. So. Yeah, he said his part, he had a lot more going on. So, I mean, me as a fan, I wouldn't mind seeing, you know, some of that footage.
No,
I
know. I agree with you. I was reacting to. I thought you were going to say, "Let's see the whole 3 hours."
No,
and I'm going,
no.
Be too long.
No, we don't need to because I think the movie is perfect as is. But to throw that bonus disc on, you know, that to me, it's sort of kind of like one of Hollywood's hidden treasures.
Yeah,
It would be fun to watch at least some of them.
Mm-hmm, sure. The scene that I want to know is why he has a black eye.
Yeah, that never got answered.
I'm sure that's somewhere in there, and I really want to know what happened. Yeah. Like, how did we get a semi truck? Mm-hmm. Of cheese, and how do you have
a black guy?
Maybe they just didn't cover it well enough with makeup. But this movie overall, it got some great ratings, and still it's on lists of favorite movies and holiday movies. Mm-hmm. And on IMDb, it has a current rating of 7.5, and I don't know the Rotten Tomatoes rating, but this movie it's still a classic, and the great thing about this movie is it's so timeless.
It's timeless.
It's really a movie you can watch at any decade and still relate to.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we're always going to have problems traveling.
Always will.
That's never going to go away.
So, until they come up with teleporters, then maybe we're
going to watch it. Phil, what was your favorite, like, say, scene or the way that a scene was put together?
For me, what I liked about it, we've kind of talked about it, but we've never really... It's the fact that they don't know each other, right? So many movies are about friends and things kind of going wrong with them and finding out secrets about each other that they didn't know before, right? But they're friends to begin with. This is two people that are not friends, and so they have no history together, and they're finding out along the way, and so you can't even really be honest. And that's what makes the comedy. There's that, we really haven't gotten anywhere. I'm clearly bringing you down. And we as the audience, the reason why it's funny is because we're in on it of like, wow, you just want to get rid of the guy. But you're doing it through such nice words. And it's like, no. Candy goes back at him. No. You know, we'll do better. No. It's fine. And then, you know, the same kind of play is with the money. Like, hey, give me your address. I'll give you the money. It's a gift.
Yeah. All the times that Neil buys things more as like parting gifts.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that didn't end up because they always end up together.
Yeah, and there's sort of an ironic line in the movie where Neil Page is yet again trying to distance himself from Dell when they're at the diner. He goes, you know, together we amount to a whole heck of a lot of nothing. Like, we don't work well together. And In hindsight.
It's not you. Yeah, it's, yeah, me.
It's me.
And yeah. Let's break up this relationship.
And the funny thing about that is they are only getting from point A to B to C because they are together. Mm-hmm. Like, they are able to get there, you know, separately. They haven't been able to get anywhere at all. They were stuck, but when they are together, they are able to get at least to the next destination or to the next adventure, to the next truck filled with cheese or to the next hotel.
Yeah, and you can make the argument, not that you would need to in a comedy like this, but you could make that. Nobody gets anywhere alone. We all have to rely on each other for something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just a reality.
I think it's another theme.
Yeah, it's another theme.
I agree.
So lays in there. Another fun Thanksgiving film that I love, I watch every year multiple times. Mm-hmm.
It's like having the same meal at Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
You have to watch the same
movie.
That's
exactly.
Nice.
It's still tradition. Every time I watch this movie, I still laugh like I've never seen it before.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's hard. I must be the only one that sort of kind of like does the little like when that do, like you just like it just makes you happy.
It's fun.
It's
don't
fun.
Know what that is. I'm sorry. What was it?
We played it at the beginning, right? Yeah, let's
The General Center. Oh.
That one right
that's
there.
That's fun. You can,
that's
and
fun.
It reflects, like dancing now.
Yes, exactly. It reflects their personalities and their behaviors with each other. They're finally having fun together.
Yeah
absolutely. One thing, if I could, I'd love to bring
Thank
up.
You, Phil.
Because
that's
we,
great.
That's awesome. And, something about John Hughes, when we talk about, he uses music to great effect, I think, in all of his movies. Mm-hmm. Did anybody know that John Hughes had his own record label?
It was
Hughes Records. He broke bands like Flesh for Lulu, and the reason why he created his own record label is because he wanted more control. He was a music, he loved music. And again, if you look at Pretty in Pink, a lot of it takes place in a record shop. You know, some of his characters are really big into music. He used that. So yeah, he created his own label so he could take control of the music and put what he wanted into his movies. And I think that's great. Again, you know, there aren't that many. I don't know who owns a. You know, I don't know any writer directors who own their own record label today.
So you could have the music.
But the music
you
industry
want.
Has changed, right? And you know, it was great. So I want to turn the hands of time back because we talked about the sensibilities and I know Phil brought up that the culture has changed from 87 to 2013, but a little, just a tad. But let's take a look at what I want to. Like sort of kind of show is okay. So this movie opened up November 25th, 1987. The movies that came out at that time, and this is right around Thanksgiving, for that weekend, the number one at the box office was Three Men and a Baby. We had a Cinderella reissue was number two. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles it was number three, and that did $7 million. Now Three Men and a Baby opened up to $10 million. Yeah, Leonard Nimoy, another Star Trek connection. But that movie opened up to $10 million, okay? And, you know, today, and look how big Three Men and a Baby at that time was, like, huge, and I'll get to how big in
Planes,
a second.
Planes was big, too. They had a budget of $30 million, I believe, and made $45 million.
It made
$49
million. It was, like, $50 million. And
back at that time, it was huge.
It had a budget of $30 million?
I didn't know if it was $30 million because I couldn't find a budget.
Too. Yeah, $30
million. Wow. I saw a thing.
Yeah,
but this movie was more successful.
They had to create whole new airlines. Think about it.
That's true.
It was
the planes themselves were so expensive.
They built them. I mean,
oh my god!
I'm kidding. I don't think.
So
that just seems like I'm shocked
by
that number.
For
yeah,
too.
That's surprising to me.
Well, I just want to like again. So we had the number one was Three Men, Cinderella reissue from Disney, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. The number four movie, Fatal Attraction.
Okay.
Was number four. Running Man with Schwarzenegger was number five. Nuts, a Barbra Streisand movie, was number six. Flowers in the Attic, which they're remaking as I think a television movie, was number seven. Teen Wolf 2,
nice.
Spelled T O O,
nice.
Was number eight. Dirty Dancing was number nine in its 15th week of release at that time.
Yeah.
And it was number nine.
Oh, goodness.
So, and then that was followed by Baby Boom, which was a Diane Keaton comedy.
I love that film.
Yep.
We should cover that one.
Yeah. And then Hello Again. And then The Princess Bride at number 12, which had been out at that time for 10 weeks. So that was the landscape back in in 1987 for this weekend. Mm-hmm. Now,
big movies.
I want to talk about like grosses, and because that has changed. Well, what we got is in 1987 for that year, the top movie was Three Men and a Baby with $167 million. Okay, 167. That was the top movie of 1987.
Really? Three Men and a Baby was the top movie?
Yep, 167. The second movie was Fatal Attraction.
Yeah, that I know did well.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Beverly Hills Cop 2 was three, and that did 153, and that was followed up by Good Morning Vietnam at $123 million. Really? Now, what I find fascinating about this is in 1987, there were only four movies that cracked $100 million, and back then that was considered a large feat. And we're talking about releasing Three Men and a Baby did that on only 1,800 screens. Okay, they hit 167.
Do Fatal you know Attraction? How many screens for Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
As a matter of fact, I do. I have that here somewhere. That was on 1,118 screens.
Wow.
Okay. Nice. So today, that is considered nothing. That's nothing.
It's
because
paltry.
Let's take a look at today, and this isn't
$100 million.
This isn't including Hunger Games, but today at 2013, top box office movies, top grossing movies, Iron Man at $409 million, Despicable Me 2, $365 million.
You're talking worldwide, right? That's not domestic.
No, we're talking domestic gross.
What?
2013 domestic.
The thing
gross.
That
Iron Man was $409. $409 million. There isn't a movie in the top 10 thus far this year that is under. The 10th movie is The Croods. That movie made $187 million thus far in 2013.
Oh my.
But the
God.
Thing is, those films that were now to the 2013s, there's special effects. There's technology. It's so grand. But, and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
No, I understand. No, I get that, but look at the release patterns. Iron Man went out on 4,253 locations.
Yeah.
Okay. Despicable Me, 4,003. Man of Steel, 4,207.
Right.
We're talking triple the amount of screens.
And you also got to adjust.
And triple the amount of money.
No, but it's amazing.
It's crazy how our distribution pattern, and again, how a Planes, Trains, and Automobile would factor in. Back in 87, a movie could play, like, Dirty Dancing was in its 15th week.
Right.
And it was still cracking the top 10. Very few movies today will
are
stick
on
around.
The screen for 15 weeks.
15 mm-hmm. weeks. Yeah,
that's unheard of.
Well, 15 weeks would be 8, 12, 3, 4 months. Yeah. In 4 months, most movies are going on to Blu-ray.
Yeah.
They're on Blu-ray in 4 months.
Crazy.
So you allowed films to play out longer to get, and again, when you hit 100 million, that was a big deal. That was huge back then. You know, and
if
it's
hit $100 million, you're hoping that the budget's under that. That's what
I know.
You're right.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right. And $100 million isn't exactly the milestone.
No.
You know, and I know like today a lot of prognosticators, you know, we'll bring up Hunger Games for 2 seconds, which we'll talk about next week, but you know, a lot of prognosticators have that in for the weekend, no lower than 165 million. That's for an opening weekend. So, you know, times have changed.
But well, Clarissa has her way. It'll be that.
I feel like today's movies nowadays is just as sad as it may sound that Hollywood spits out movies just to make money. And back then in the 1980s, Hollywood spat out movies to tell a story.
A lot of them, or to tell something different. And
I don't know. I'm going to take the devil's advocate point of view on that. I think the business side of Hollywood always just makes movies to make money.
That's true.
And I think there's just as many movies now that are made for art.
Yeah,
they're harder
80s.
To get made. But every generation, every decade, they say it's harder to get an art movie made. It's harder, and they say it every decade. So I don't really know if it's harder now to make a movie just for artistic purposes or not. I just know that everybody says it's harder.
Well,
for me, I think writers have moved on to TV, and
that's clear.
Where lots of writers back then used to write for film, and they were the amazing writers of their time.
Yeah.
You know, now it's like, okay, well, you know what? We want job security, we want this and that, and you know, we want to tell a longer story, and we want to tell it well. Hence, they're on TV.
Yeah, because they have more, and they have far more avenues for which to get their product to the market.
Yeah, and again, to your point regarding making art for art's sake, so to speak. You know, Cammy, we talked about this a little. There was big news this past week about Sony Pictures. Not only are they looking to trim over $100 million off of their overhead. They've also, yesterday was a big announcement that they're cutting their film slate back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what's happening today anyways is there is this part of attrition, like where studios are not releasing as many movies as they used to. And what's happening now is like they are looking for more franchises.
Yeah.
They're looking for the bigger picture where that middle picture may not find its place the way it used to.
But you're also seeing other things, because you've got your Netflix, you've got your Amazon, you got all these other content providers that are looking for original programming, not just for TV viewing or for episodic, but they're also looking for original content for so they can be considered a production house, so to speak.
True.
And get content that way. So it's going to be interesting how to see how that all plays out.
You know, but bottom line for me is, you know, I don't want the movies to go away.
No.
You know, we don't want the theatrical experience. You know, we
We want more movies.
We want more movies. Yeah. And we do want more movies. Absolutely. And, you know, and back in again, we're only talking 26 years, which in the whole grand scheme of thing isn't a whole hell of a lot.
No, but it is 26 years is a great time difference because nowadays
it's a generation, basically.
Yeah, we have better ways to promote the movies. We have the internet. We have social media websites. We have our phones that have connection to the internet. Nowadays, we can generate more money because we have things, accessibility to things to promote it faster.
But you're right. But again, when you're looking
very quickly once they do.
No, but you're right. But when you have like a Three Men and a Baby, which does $167 million with the tools that they had to market it.
Not only that, but you have to consider there's so much more product out there for people to take. Because you only have a finite time for each audience member to see things.
True.
So all the slew of stuff you can see on the internet, all the stuff you can see on TV with all the channels like crazy. So even though you might have better ways to advertise to them, you're
competing
pool
against
of – yeah, you're competing against way more.
By the way, I mean there's a statistic out there where, you know, you used to talk about opening weekend and you kind of – that was its own thing. Now, literally – people can go see on a Friday night and you can kind of project where it's going to be Sunday. But if social media all of a sudden said Hunger Games is the worst movie ever,
Which we're not saying.
We're not.
We love it.
I'm making an example, people. If this Friday people all of a sudden start tweeting, don't ever see Hunger Games, by Sunday, the movie's dead.
But they won't, because people have already been tweeting that it's amazing.
Yes.
All right, we get your point.
Not even out.
Yeah, well, you know, but and I'll go back to, you know, but it's interesting because I'll go back to that first Twilight movie, which everybody pretty much said was garbage, but it didn't keep that movie or that juggernaut from making, that movie made a ton of money, and the next movie is what we
That's a fantastic comedy.
Yeah. But I think I like Phil's point, though.
Yeah, it's a great point.
It can, you can make or break a film, but even a great film, if it gets the wrong press too early, can kill it.
Well, you know,
and it's just for crying out loud, it's social media.
I know.
You're going to use that as your barometer? I mean, it's social media. I mean, well, word of mouth is good or bad, but can you make up your own mind?
Also, the thing is with Planes, Trains, I think it's more generated to family and adults and some kids here and there. But the, like, Hunger Games and whatnot, that's geared towards the teenagers, the young adult generation demographic, and who uses the social media websites more so than the young adults.
Mm-hmm. But also, you know, if we're really going to dissect this, part for me, and I'd be interested in Cammy's perspective on this, is that, you know, you used to have home viewing and, you know, you could perhaps watch this as a family. Now, you know, you gather to see a movie. One has an iPad, one has his iPhone, one has his PS4 that he's playing, and, you know, the family members are trying to watch this movie, but nobody gives a shit.
No.
No, but you know what I mean? There's so many ways to segment your time just within that, like, Lots of bonding time that, you know, it just gets lost. And so how do you, even as just a family, have a family movie night?
No, we do. And actually, we still love the whole physical content, watching a movie. I mean, my kids have iPads, they have iPods, they have the Xboxes. But we still watch.
Can we come over and play?
Yes, yes. It'll be a big party, more than family. And just like when we watched Planes and Trains last week, we all still love watching it, you know, on the big screen.
But that's because you guys have made an effort. You especially, I'm sure, has made an effort of having that happen, and that's kind of a regular thing, right?
Yeah, we love the experience. I mean, there's nothing like watching the movie like that, not on an iPad or, you know, smaller technology device. So,
and I can attest Cammy is very family.
Good to you,
and, yeah, and it is, and it's great because
it is, cause it's great dividends. Will, not only you get to that had experience, but great dividends down the line. I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, but you're right. And I was going to, you know, just to further that, I mean, Cammy, I always hear these great, she always says, like, you know, we took the kids and their friends and we went to go see Man of Steel. You know, we bought tickets ahead of time. We got all this or whatever other family picture, you know, and I think that, you know, I wish there were more people like that. And because it is important, like the movie going experience, and to have the kids love that sort of thing. Your kids loved Hunger Games. And again, at that screening, right, that you took your family. You know that your kids really wanted to see this movie and you saw it on a big screen and it wasn't about the iPad. And you're right, there are way, Phil, you know, to your point, there are way more diversions, we'll call them today. Then
well, there's
than
debate everybody. About having iPhones in a movie theater.
Oh yeah,
let's not get into that.
Yeah, but you know, I guess me personally, I don't want to speak for anybody here because you know some of my thoughts are just dopey. But I love the movie theater going experience. I always have as a kid. I don't think that the movie experience is ever going to go away. It may get smaller, but I think what will evolve is the experience itself. We're already seeing it. The large format specialty type theater, like that's becoming more relevant today. The dine-in theater is becoming very popular. You know, they're making, you know, sound. I mean, you see a movie in Dolby Atmos sound. You know, they're changing the way of the experience, which I think is fantastic.
Pretty soon you're going to have the virtual thing. You're going to be in the movie as it's happening.
Yeah, you could be.
I want a re-release of this movie in theaters.
Yeah. It would be great.
I was not around when this movie came out.
Well, why not do it on the 30th anniversary?
Yeah, why
not? You know, do it and, you know, have it in memoriam for John Candy. Release that Blu-ray.
And John Hughes.
And John Hughes. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and see what happens. You know, but again, I'm not sure if Paramount will take the risk. Yeah.
This movie's timeless. And every time I watch this, it's sentimental. Oh. It hits home with me. I just can't say enough good things about this movie.
It's a good time to see it. So.
Yeah. So yes, definitely. To keep this conversation going, if you can't get enough of this movie, where can everyone find you, Dimitri? Go ahead.
You can find me here at Anatomy of a Movie. Go in at anatomyofamovie.com. Write your comments. I'll write back. Been starting to look at comments, which is great that people are writing comments. Go on iTunes.
Go on iTunes. YouTube. Download Anatomy of a Movie podcast. We have other great films that we dissect. I know Sarah and John, you aren't really on Twitter.
But you can find me at Cammy's house playing Xbox with the kids.
That's right. I'll be there too.
Come over.
Cammy, where can we find you?
You can find me at cammy.martinez@technicolor.com.
Excellent. And Phil, thank you for engineering in the booth. You can find him here at Anatomy of a Movie. You can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at SerafiniTV. And follow all of us here at Movie Anatomy on Twitter. And check out our awesome website, anatomyofamovie.com.
And,
so basically lots of places.
Lots of places.
You're everywhere.
And happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving. You know, hopefully your traveling experience is better than these two. You know,
but hopefully you get something out of it in the end.
Yes.
Outside of just turkey and stuffing.
All right.
Bring a new friend. Bring a new friend.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the message, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Include someone else.
All right. Thank
you
guys.
Come to Thanksgiving.
Yeah, come on over, everybody.
Thanksgiving for everybody. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. And we'll see you next film.
Every time you go away.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.